Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, email, Google+, simple ways that you can share Issues Etc. programs with your friends, relatives, and fellow parishioners. Just go to Listen on Demand Archives at issuesetc.org and look for the share feature images posted beneath each audio segment. You're only one click away from telling someone about Issues Etc. The Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org and look for Share This.
We will not see the end of threats like ISIS until we repent of our addiction to fossil fuels.
This is the end, my only friend, the end.
A growing majority of Americans, about 72% now, say that religion is losing influence in American life, and most who hold this view think that this is a bad thing.
I tell the story of attending a large Bible church where the pastor started off with a bunch of shoulds, and he finished with a bunch of shoulds, and he should all over us the entire sermon.
Hello. I want to say that foreigners with English as a second language also love Issues Etc. Hi.
There are few philosophers that rise to the level of making an impact in Christian theology the way that David Hume did. It's difficult to tell whether David Hume was even a believer in a God. It's hard to tell whether he was an atheist. If he was consistent with his own philosophy, which was radically skeptical, he would probably have to end being an agnostic, because a skeptic can't say for sure that there isn't a God. He would be skeptical of even that particular proclamation. The best that the thoroughgoing skeptic could possibly be is an agnostic. And maybe that's what David Hume was, but just because he didn't believe in God doesn't mean that his particular philosophy didn't find its way into the halls of Christian academia in a rather pernicious way. His denial of, categorical denial of miracles based upon the fact that he'd never seen one, that one had never been observed, in at least in a way he considered reliable, gave fuel to higher criticism to liberal Bible scholarship like nothing else did. And much of that still survives today owes more to David Hume than it does to any kind of real, honest biblical scholarship. We're going to conclude our five-part series on the important philosophers today, 18th century Scottish philosopher David Hume. Dr. Angus Manouge will be our guest here in just a moment. A little bit later, we're going to be talking with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, the results of Ayn Rand's philosophy. Her philosophy was called objectivism, and she's often the darling of libertarians and people who are kind of the politically naive, is what I call them, the politically naive, who kind of believe in her idealistic world, the one that she spins in both her philosophy and in her novels. What do you do when you mix Ayn Rand's philosophy, her enlightened self-interest, her rational self-interest, with the sexual revolution? Well, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse knows firsthand, and she'll tell her story a little bit later here on Issues Etc. Then in hour two, Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer will be our guest. We're going to be doing our Christ in the Old Testament series in Isaiah chapter 5, The Vineyard of the Lord Abandoned. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MY-IE. Send us an email, talkback at issuesetc.org. Or a tweet at IssuesETC. And for our beloved on-demand listeners, don't forget the Issues Etc. comment line. Leave a question, comment, show suggestion there anytime you want to. 618-223-8382. 618-223-8382. Dr. Angus Manouge joins us for the conclusion of our five-part series on important philosophers today. We wade into the skepticism of 18th century Scottish philosopher David Hume. Dr. Angus Manouge is professor and chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin, and president of the Evangelical Philosophical Society. Dr. Manouge, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me again, and thanks for doing this series.
Where would we see David Hume's influence in our thinking today?
I think two main places. One is a good thing. We recognize the fallibility of science. What Hume taught us is that no matter how many times we've observed something in the past, the future could be different. His famous work on induction, if you've run into nothing but white swans, you can't claim to know that all swans are white. Tomorrow you might run into a black swan. And he demolishes the idea that there is any logical connection between what we've observed in the past and what we might find in the future. And therefore, scientists need to take a very tentative attitude, and they need to expose their theories to testing and falsification. The bad side, though, is because he was a resolute empiricist, and he would only believe those things that could be grounded on what he could find within his own mind. He had a very low view of human dignity, or at least his ideas promote one, because he's skeptical about the existence of the self, which he claims he cannot discover when he introspects. He's skeptical about any argument for the existence of God. He doesn't really believe in objective moral values. He argues at length that justice is simply a convention that is introduced because it serves people's mutual interests. This is very different from justice being built into the nature of God and therefore not dependent on how human beings live at all. And he's skeptical about just about everything, personal identity, and even the very idea of laws of nature. It's hard to find such a skeptical philosopher since Pyrrho of Athens, who took over the academy after Aristotle's time, the skeptical view that dominated then.
Tell us a little bit about his life, a brief biography, if you will.
He sort of had three careers. He started out as a philosopher, being born in Edinburgh, Scotland, although he did also visit France in La Flèche, where Descartes received his training. And he writes his first book, A Treatise of Human Nature, now considered his greatest, when he was only 28 years old, and he says it fell stillborn from the press. Nobody was interested in the book, so he thought, well, maybe it's too difficult. So then he wrote two more accessible versions, his inquiries concerning human understanding and the principles of morals, and they also really didn't catch on. And so for a while, Hume decided to follow a couple of different careers. He was a historian. He did a six-volume history of England that was the standard for about 100 years until Macaulay's classic work took its place. And he also got into economics and monetarist theory and interacted with the other famous Scotsman of the time, Adam Smith, and was actually better known in his lifetime as an economist than as a philosopher.
You said a resolute empiricist. Take that little term apart for us, if you would.
Basically, what Hume does, much like Bishop Berkeley, is he thinks that the way you do philosophy is you examine the contents of your own mind, okay? And you try to find out where its contents, you know, what they tell you about what's real. So the idea of the empiricist program is you only accept as real those things which, where you actually receive what Hume called an impression in your mind, or only those ideas which you can derive from those sensory impressions. And as a result, he was sympathetic with Berkeley's view that perhaps there isn't a real world out there. And certainly, though, unlike Berkeley, he was also very skeptical of any theistic view of reality. It's difficult to peg him because he writes in an ironic style. It seems from many of his writings that he is an atheist, but it's possible that he's an agnostic and is simply skeptical on both sides of the question.
I mean, wouldn't it, just as an aside here, were he consistent with his own framework, he could never be a resolute atheist. He would simply have to remain agnostic.
Yeah, and that's what you see going back to Pyrrho of Athens. They were a very frustrating group of skeptics who simply said that, well, you withhold assent either to a statement or its denial. You know, in other words, both of them you find some reason to doubt, and therefore, as a result, you say you believe nothing. And of course, Hume realized that this was completely impossible to live out, hence he's called a mitigated skeptic, because he admitted that in life, of course, our beliefs form in this customary fashion, whether we like it or not. And after he'd gone through doubts about just about everything, he'd say he'd play backgammon with his friends, assuming that he was a person and they were a person, and that cause and effect worked as normal, and all the things he previously cast doubt on theoretically, he would have to assume as soon as he acted. So he was aware, as soon as we act in life, we assume that some things are more reliable than others. So if you go out, you assume it's safe to go out. If you stay home, well, then aren't you assuming it's safer to stay home than to go out? And so in life, it's not really possible to be a skeptic.
He, if I'm given to believe, was willing to be skeptical about some things that most philosophers, this is where angels fear to tread. We had spoken in earlier conversations about innate knowledge, things like causation, non-contradiction, all of those kinds of things that earlier generations of philosophers simply assumed or would classify as a knowledge that we know, at least in some sense, or acquire in some sense, as perhaps infallible and a priori. He questions these things. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, even such a fundamental idea as causation, okay, which other philosophers have thought is simply a given, okay? It's built in that one thing can cause another. Well, what Hume says is, what do we actually observe? Constant conjunction. So we see, you know, there's a constant conjunction between a lowering of temperature and water freezing. Billiard ball A strikes billiard ball B, it goes off in a certain direction. And so as a result of custom, he says, we expect that similar causes will have similar effects. But actually, we don't observe the causal connection itself. Because the idea of cause, he says, that we have is that there is some kind of necessity. But we don't observe necessity. We simply observe one thing and then another. And there is no logical connection between the cause and the effect. For all we can tell, the same cause could produce a quite different effect on another occasion. And that, as well, is very closely connected to his problem of induction. He says that as a result of custom, we expect the future to be like the past, because we've seen many instances where the, you know, autumn comes round and the trees lose their leaves, or bread nourishes, or the sun rises every day. We expect it to be that way in the future. But there is a logical gap, because the future does not have to be like the past. That argument is, in fact, invalid. And so he says, well, what would help us out here, of course, is if we could assume that nature is uniform. Trouble is, our only reason to believe nature is uniform is because that's the way it's been in the past, and that is to use an inductive argument. And so he says any attempt to show that induction is irrational principle is actually based on induction, which would be circular. And so we simply have to accept that that's the way we think, but we can't provide a logical justification. In a way, it's quite profound, because it shows that at the foundation of science, there is actually a kind of faith. If we're going to do science, we have to assume that there's an orderly, law-governed world. And actually, on the basis simply of our past experience, we can't prove that that's the case.
Does he go so far as to question whether or not he exists? We talked earlier about René Descartes, who comes up with a simple answer to that question. I think, therefore, I am. What about Hume?
He basically says, well, I only have experiences, and therefore, maybe I don't exist. He says that whenever he enters most intimately into what I call myself, he says, I always stumble on some particular perception or other. I never catch myself at any time without a perception, and I can never observe anything but the perception. And so he says he never perceives an I, an ego, a self. It's not an empirical idea. And since he's only willing to be certain about what's empirical, he concludes there's no grounds to think that the self exists, which is a truly remarkable conclusion. And, you know, as later philosophers pointed out, it even seems to be in some sense self-contradictory, that he pushes skepticism so far that he appears to undermine himself. Kant, for example, who comes on, he was awoken from his dogmatic slumbers by Hume and forced to examine these difficult questions. But of course, Kant points out that, well, you know, basically, who is this individual who's comparing these different experiences? When you say, well, you can never find yourself, okay, so on several occasions, you look inside your mind and you don't find yourself. Well, who's doing this? So the ego or the I is not so much an object of experience, but is that thing which unites and has all those experiences on multiple occasions. And so the response to Hume by many philosophers is simply that the I is presupposed by the unity of our experience and our ability to compare today's experiences with ones in the past and so on.
What about morality?
On morality, Hume is a very subtle and sophisticated theorist, but he seems really to be more interested in giving a naturalistic account of how our moral sense developed. And this was also taken up later by Adam Smith and even in Charles Darwin's work on the descent of man. He takes the view, for example, that in a wild state, there really is no such thing as justice. He says that justice establishes itself by a kind of convention or agreement, that is, by a sense of interest. And without such a convention, no one would ever have dreamed that there was such a virtue as justice. So according to him, if you were in the wild and there was no society operating, you could simply kill somebody else if it served your interest, and you would not have done an injustice. So he's completely closed to the idea that justice has a transcendent foundation. And furthermore, his account of morality is mainly explaining our moral evaluations in terms of sentiments, how we feel, and in terms of sympathy. And this, of course, has a long subsequent history where it led many ethicists into subjectivism and emotivism, where they're not really able to give an objective basis for judgments of right or wrong, but rather an account of moral psychology, which only explains why people feel that things are either right or wrong. So this is really quite disturbing, and in fact it leads to the logical positivism that was the target of C.S. Lewis in his book Abolition of Man, where he says that what the positivists have done is created the impression that our moral sentiments can't be either appropriate or inappropriate to reality, because there isn't any objective basis out there. There are no objective moral values that they can either correspond or fail to correspond to.
Dr. Angus Manoogian is our guest. We're concluding our five-part series with him on the important philosophers today. 18th-century Scottish philosopher David Hume. Dr. Manoogian is professor and chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin, and he is president of the Evangelical Philosophical Society. We'll have a couple more questions for him on the other side of the break. Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse will join us a little bit later in this hour. We'll talk about the results of Ayn Rand's philosophy. She has her own story to tell about the mixture of Ayn Rand's objectivism, enlightened self-interest, and the sexual revolution. It's actually her own story. Then Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer will join us for Christ in the Old Testament. Today we'll be in Isaiah chapter 5. I'm working on the second part of a two-part essay that the first part appears in the Latest Issues, Etc. journal, called Lord's Day, Lord's House, Lord's Supper. And the Issues, Etc. journal is a free journal online that anyone can have by just going to our website, issuesetc.org. Click the red button in the right-hand side, enter your email address, and we will send you absolutely free the Issues, Etc. journal. The latest one is out with the part one of the Lord's Day, Lord's House, Lord's Supper essay. And then an excellent Wittenberg Trail feature, just unbelievable story told by Pastor Dennis McFadden of his life for six decades as a Baptist pastor. And finally, in the last, as a Lutheran pastor and how he got there. Find out more about the Issues, Etc. journal and back issues at our website, issuesetc.org. For those back issues, just click the publications link at issuesetc.org. When we come back, we're going to talk about Hume's view of miracles. He has a view of miracles that is, well, found its way into Christian academia and pretty much gutted Holy Scripture. We'll find out what it was with Dr. Angus Manoogian right after this. Do you have a hard time finding Christian greeting cards and gifts that aren't either sappy or theologically suspect? Ad Crucem offers the perfect combination of art and the truth of the Scriptures with beautiful and reverent greeting cards and gifts. Deliver the true comfort of the gospel, Christ crucified for sinners, to family and friends with Ad Crucem. ADCRUCEM.com. Confessing the faith through art and word. AdCrucem.com.
Hymnody is important, very important. It's an invaluable tool that helps teach and confess the faith. Singing hymns is something we all do together on a weekly basis, yet some congregations find it difficult to sing confidently without the support of an instrument. If you are one of these congregations that can't find an organist, Church Music Solutions can help. Our substitute organist service allows your hymns and liturgy to be played on your instrument to help inspire and support your congregation's song. Keep singing with Church Music Solutions.
Your lifeline to the Lutheran worldview. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Bethany Lutheran College is pleased to sponsor Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio. Bethany Lutheran College is located in the picturesque river town of Mankato, Minnesota, and is committed to making Christian higher education affordable for all with generous financial aid packages available. At Bethany, you'll find stimulating academic programs, a friendly atmosphere, and opportunities to grow both in intellect and in your faith, all within the framework of a supportive Christian environment. For more information, visit us on the web at blc.edu.
Those beautiful notes were just the beginning of We Praise You and Acknowledge You, O God, Concordia Publishing House's debut CD collection from Pastor Stephen Starkey, one of the most significant Lutheran hymn writers of our time. For a limited time, save 10% when you use promotional code URA. Simply visit cph.org today. Lutheran thought, Lutheran substance, Lutheran music, brought to you by Concordia Publishing House.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're concluding our five-part series on the important philosophers, and today we're talking about 18th century Scottish philosopher David Hume with Dr. Angus Manoogian. I failed to mention this at the beginning of the program, and I really wanted to, but my memory slipped. We heard some very sad news earlier today that last night sometime, regular guest here and longtime friend of Issues Etc., Gretchen Pasentino Coburn, suffered what appears to be some kind of a heart attack, and her condition is very dicey, to say the least. I haven't heard anything since about 7 o'clock this morning, but certainly call our listeners to be praying for Gretchen. If you've listened to Issues Etc. for any amount of time, you know what she brought as a guest to the air here. Her expertise and years, decades of experience firsthand dealing with apologetics issues. Her and her late husband, Bob, really were pioneers in a lot of this and just giants in Christian apologetics. And to hear that she has fallen ill now, we certainly want our listeners to pray for both her and her recovery, but also for her husband, Pat, who suffered a similar kind of incident several years back. And the two of them have been struggling a lot. So please, if you would, keep Gretchen Pasentino Coburn and Pat Coburn in your prayers. Send them a line if you can. Dr. Manoogian, we know that probably the most famous of Hume's ideas does have to do with miracles. How would you explain how he applies his skepticism to the miraculous?
Yeah, in his later work, when he does his inquiry concerning human understanding, he adds a chapter there of miracles, which was not in his original treatise of human nature. And what he does is he argues basically both in principle and in fact against miracles. That is to say, the first argument is to say that you could never in principle have good reason to believe in miracle. And the second is this: we don't in fact have good evidence. So the first argument, what it says, is that if somebody brings testimony of a miracle, suppose they say they've seen that a dead person has risen from the dead, or a paralyzed person is now walking, or whatever it might be. Hume says that you need to set against that testimony the uniform experience of the past course of nature, where dead people stay dead, and people who have terrible debilitations, they stay that way. And so you could never have good reason to believe the testimony of this apparent miracle. It would always be more reasonable to think that either the person was deceived, it was an illusion or trick of some kind, or that they were a deceiver. And then, of course, he goes through and says as well that he doesn't find the particular accounts of miracles that he's aware of very persuasive either. And so it's a very direct and at first seemingly powerful attack on the central Christian claim of miracles.
How was that taken up within Christendom, by higher criticism, by skeptical Christian scholarship?
Yeah, the sad thing is, if you look at the legacy of theology after Hume, so many of the theologians, and you see this in Strauss and later figures, when they look back, they now begin to assume as a methodological principle that we should not believe texts that appear to report miracles. And so astonishingly, here you have people who call themselves theologians who are sifting through the scriptures, but with the assumption that if there are accounts of miracles, they're probably unreliable embellishments. And this is really quite absurd, since the Christian religion is founded on nothing but miracle, the incarnation, the resurrection. Without these, we don't really have a Christian faith at all, and yet the scripture is being subjected to this kind of historical criticism.
You mentioned before that he is at best an agnostic. How would you describe his views on the existence of God?
Well, on the existence of God, what he tries to do, and this comes out in the last work, which he was published posthumously, Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, he tries to discredit the various arguments of natural theology. He takes on the argument from design, and he pours scorn on this. He says, well, why are you working from the nature of human beings? What's special about us? He says, why select so minute, so weak, so bounded a principle as the reason and design of animals is found to be on this planet? And he suggests, if you start extrapolating from things, wouldn't you have to consider evil? If you're going to suggest that God is like various things, if there are arguments from analogies, you could go all over the place. Perhaps he's like a big animal or even a vegetable. And there are all sorts of amazing possible suggestions which he gives during that dialogue. Although, to his credit, he does at times appear to admit that none of them really are as plausible as the design hypothesis. But what he is trying to do is to unseat the certainty of the design hypothesis, because at that time there were many strong natural theologians that felt that they really had a clinching argument for God's existence.
How big of an impact, let's start with negative, how big of a negative impact has Hume and his thinking had in both religion and in society?
I think in religion it's been a huge negative impact, because it's led to all kinds of skepticism in theology, being somehow thought to be somehow necessary to be academically objective. And so you get the rise of the idea of neo-Orthodox theology, where the important claims of the faith are somehow only accessible through faith, but they're not historical facts. So there is a tendency to distrust important biblical claims where they touch on history, and therefore really to undermine the idea that this is God's inerrant, infallible word. You know, perhaps God speaks through it, but there's an awful lot of it which is not going to be taken to be trustworthy. It's going to be viewed as legendary material. So I think that what Hume starts here has an enormous and negative impact on people's views about the trustworthiness of Scripture. And on society, I think it has led through the positivists in particular, it's had the very negative impact of making people think that claims of both ethics and religion are really just matters of emotion. So we have, as Francis Schaeffer talks about, the two-story mind, right, where science occupies the lower story and can tell you about objective fact, But in the upper story, you have these things called values. And what are they? They are associated with our feelings and the skepticism that in ethics we really can't determine whether anything is really right or wrong. And then in religion, that religion is really just a matter of preference. And Hume is always sort of giving as an out to the religious person, well, you know, of course, this just shows how much faith goes beyond reason and the miracle of faith and all the rest of it. And that is clearly ironic. What he's really saying is, yes, you can still be religious if you don't mind being totally irrational, which you see, you know, in the claims of the new atheists today.
Dr. Angus Manoogian is our guest. When we come back, 10 more minutes with him, concluding our series on important philosophers today. We're talking about 18th century Scottish philosopher David Hume. And when we come back, we'll talk about the possible, if there is any, positive influence that David Hume's thinking had on Christianity. After our conversation with Dr. Manoogian, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse will be our guest. She's going to tell us her personal story and how the philosophy of Ayn Rand and the sexual revolution came together in her life and the results there. She says it's not for the young and not for the impressionable and certainly not for the selfish. All of those things she says she certainly was in her youth. And, well, the sad results of Ayn Rand's philosophy and the sexual revolution, she'll tell us all about them when she joins us a little bit later. Then we're going to do our series, Christ in the Old Testament. Today we'll be in a very famous part of Isaiah chapter 5, where there is a reoccurring story that God tells again and again and again, the story of his people, his vineyard. Jesus actually even picks up on this in the New Testament with one of his most famous parables, one that is told right before his crucifixion. It's the one that finally, at long last, his opponents realize he is telling this parable against them. It's the parable of the vineyard, and it has its roots in Isaiah chapter 5. There's a great organization that is having, well, I went to their last conference, was to speak at their last conference several years ago, LCMSU, their flagship conference that they held at St. Louis University was a great success, and they've decided to repeat it at the same place, right around the same time. January the 9th through the 11th this year, LCMSU is going to hold its conference. It's called Taboo. They plan to deal with the subjects that are considered kind of off the table for discussion. As I said, it's January 9th through the 11th. You can find out more about LCMSU and about their Taboo conference at their website. It's lcms.org/LCMSU, lcms.org/LCMSU. The Taboo conference is January the 9th through the 11th at St. Louis University. I'm Todd Wilkin. A few more minutes with Dr. Angus Manoogian right after this.
Do you have a student finishing up eighth grade at a Lutheran school? Do you wish there were a Lutheran high school close to where you live so your student could continue going to a Lutheran school? What if there was an opportunity for high school students in public or Lutheran school to take classes like Latin, logic, and hard-hitting theology courses? Well, there is. It's called Wittenberg Academy, the first completely online classical Lutheran high school. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Holy Trinity Lutheran, Garfield, New Jersey. Grace Lutheran, Naples, Florida. St. John's Lutheran, Chicago, Illinois. St. Paul Lutheran, Unionville, Michigan. Mount Calvary Lutheran, Beverly Hills, California. Epiphany Lutheran, Door, Michigan. The Good Shepherd Lutheran, Inglewood, California. St. John's Lutheran, Sayville, New York. Apostles Lutheran, Melrose Park, Illinois. Christ Our Savior Lutheran, Elizabeth, Colorado. Grace Lutheran, Strasburg, Illinois. And Bethel Lutheran, Thunder Bay, Ontario, Canada. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal, the Issues Etc. 300.
Whether building a new home, remodeling an existing home, or tackling the weekend project, it is important to have the materials and advice needed to get the job done. RP Lumber offers estimates for professional building materials and services for drywall, decking, siding, shingles, cabinets, and kitchen and bath design to the general contractor and the individual homeowner. Delivery available with over 50 local community locations. For 37 years, RP Lumber.
Welcome back. We're talking about the 18th century Scottish philosopher David Hume with Dr. Angus Manoush, concluding our five-part series on important philosophers with him. It is Thursday, October the 2nd. Dr. Manoush, it's hard to imagine how a radical skepticism could possibly aid Christianity. Christianity is not necessarily aided in any way by the kind of skepticism that doubts all things, including whether or not there may be a God. So one has to wonder whether or not his philosophy could have any positive influence on Christianity. Is there any at all? And if so, what is it, Dr. Manoush?
Well, the positive attitude would be that, in fact, I think he shows just how negative his naturalistic empiricism is. It leads to the view that, in effect, we're imprisoned in our own minds and can't know reality for what it is. We can't know the reality of ourselves, the world around us, other people, laws of nature. We're just stuck in this world of experience. We're, in fact, right back in Plato's cave. And if Hume is right, we're not only stuck in Plato's cave, we don't even know who we are while we're there. And in some ways, that's a service, because surely at that point, it would make you interested in alternative philosophies. What I think Hume does is he paves the way for Gotthold, the ideas of people like Gotthold Lessing, where he talks about this ugly ditch where we cannot get from the facts of history to any transcendent truth. Well, you know, on empiricist assumptions, that's exactly true. But what if it's the other way around? What if God becomes man? Okay, as we see in John 14, and Philip asks, well, will you show us the Father? And Jesus says, you who have seen me have seen the Father. What if the transcendent becomes incarnate? In other words, what if there we are in Plato's cave, sitting around with Hume, not feeling terribly happy, and in fact, God himself comes down and liberates us, and we come to know the transcendent, because the transcendent comes into this world. To use C.S. Lewis's analogy, it would be as if Shakespeare had written himself into Hamlet so that finally Hamlet could know who the author of the play really was. So this crisis that he causes, in many ways, can be turned to good account. It shows us what a wonderful release of captivity is provided by the Christian faith.
Finally on Hume, someone might ask, there are so many other philosophers that kind of stand in the modern era. Why did you choose him to stand out as, you know, the fifth and the final of the important philosophers closest to us?
Because I think he shows, as Thomas Reed and Kant realized, he shows this trajectory. Reed charges that these people began with the wrong assumption, that if you try to build your account from inside the mind working out, you will end in skepticism and failure. And so what this shows is, in fact, you need to begin from the assumption that our minds are designed. Reed talks about how if you don't assume such things as the existence of self, reason, moral norms, and all the rest of it, all the projects of human life will fall apart. And so you have to trust that they are built into us from the beginning. Then all of a sudden you can make sense of all kinds of things, including the doability of science and our behavior and all the rest of it. I should say, if I can, just a little bit of, in response to his argument against miracles.
Sure. Yeah, let's do that.
It's very important to notice that subsequent thinkers have shown that his argument is fallacious. great book on this, Hume's Abject Failure by John Ehrman, who points out what Thomas Sherlock had noticed in Hume's day, that what Hume does when he says you have this whole weight of experience against the miraculous, he is simply adding up the frequency of such events. But what convinces us that something happened in history is quite different. We don't use inductive logic. We just look at the testimony surrounding this particular case. Okay, so in the case of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, well, it didn't happen in the past. So you could say it's very unlikely, but we can certainly be convinced that it did happen now. Or somebody who's never been married, using Hume's argument, you could say, well, look, they haven't been married all these years, so you shouldn't believe they're married now. But, of course, you can be convinced by compelling current testimony that something new has happened. And, in fact, C.S. Lewis pointed out that Hume's whole approach here, his argument against miracles, is inconsistent with his very reasonable doubts about induction. Because in the case of the swans, you've had uniform experience of white swans, so then you should never believe anybody's testimony that here's a black swan. But, of course, we do. We can be convinced by the facts. So the facts can simply overpower the expectations that we have had in the past. And it's now widely recognized that Hume's argument here is actually entirely fallacious.
Finally then, Dr. Manoj, we've spent this time talking about the various bright lights of philosophy. Why is it vitally important that Christians not only be familiar with these ideas, ancient and more modern, be able to converse in them and engage them? Why is it particularly important that Christians endeavor to do that?
I like to think of Colossians 2:8, where Paul says, "See to it that you're not taken captive by these deceitful philosophies that come from the world and not from Christ." The fact is, we all have a philosophy because we all have a worldview. The only question is whether it's going to be good or bad, and it happens to be that there are a lot of bad and deceitful philosophies out there which undermine the claims of the Christian faith. Once you realize that, then it's a good idea to study some philosophy so that you can find out what the best responses are. Otherwise, you're going into battle and you don't have the right armor and the right weapons. And it's amazing how many well-meaning and in their hearts faithful Christians are all the time surrendering to these destructive and false philosophies. We see that in the religious surveys, for example, where people who will self-identify as Christians, but actually they are moralistic, therapeutic deists and hold views which are not compatible with historic Christian doctrine. How did that happen? Well, because their mind was infiltrated by unrecognized philosophies. So you need some philosophy to recognize philosophies and to critique them when they're taking you away from what you should believe as a Christian.
Is this precisely what, or at least an extension of what the apostle says when he talks about not being the Christianity not being the product of vain philosophies, but in fact, the apostles again and again and again demonstrate that they are quite conversant in the, let's just for lack of a better word, call them the world views of their day.
Yeah, I mean, Paul in Acts 17 in the Areopagus, it's clear that he wants to correct their idolatry and their belief that gods can be contained in things built by human hands, but he is also conversant with their Stoicism and their Epicurean views, and he's willing to speak in their categories so that then he can critique and show their limitations. One of the things Paul does so powerfully is that the ancient world had this idea of the wise man who, using philosophy, had figured out how to flourish and be virtuous in this world. And, of course, where is the wise man? Where is the philosopher? You can't find anybody who's done this. And the reason is, of course, because of sin. And the wise man that they're looking for is, in fact, Christ. And it's in Christ, then, that the righteousness that we need and can never produce of ourselves is to be found. And so in order to give an antidote that's comprehensible to a particular person, you have to show how it applies within their worldview, within their categories, and it serves to solve problems that they themselves have and can recognize.
Dr. Angus Manoj is professor and chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin. He is president of the Evangelical Philosophical Society, and you can find out more about the Evangelical Philosophical Society at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Manoj, thanks for being our guest.
Thanks very much, Todd. Thank you.
By the way, if you have missed or if you just like to listen again to any part of this entire five-part series on Important Philosophers with Dr. Angus Manoj, we're going to be playing it in its entirety, all five parts, immediately after the broadcast of Issues Etc. today at issuesetc.org. That's our Best of Issues Etc. online channel. You just go there, issuesetc.org, click Lutheran Talk, and you will listen right after the live broadcast of Issues Etc. today to all five parts of our series with Dr. Angus Manoj on the Important Philosophers, kicking off with Plato, going back to the ancient roots of human thinking, Thomas Aquinas, still within the Christian pale, medieval Christianity, on to René Descartes, where he is putting a little distance between himself and the Christian worldview, John Locke, even more distance there, and finally, what we just finished talking about, David Hume, who has Christianity fully at arm's length. It's all there in a great summary from one of the best Christian philosophers we've got going today, Dr. Angus Manoj. All five parts of our series on the Important Philosophers immediately after the live broadcast of Issues Etc. today at issuesetc.org. It's just one click away right after the live broadcast today. He's quite right. What we need to know is how man thinks. And in order to know that, we have to know how man has thought in the past. A lot of our ideas, well, none of our ideas are new. Most of them, if not all of them, have been borrowed either knowingly or unknowingly from someone else. This is why if the Christian is to engage the world, they must know the world's mind as well as the mind of Christ. And that's why we do a series just like this. When we come back on this Thursday afternoon, October the 2nd, Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse of the Ruth Institute will tell us about the toxic mix of Ayn Rand's philosophy and the sexual revolution. It's really her own story, and we'll hear it right after this.
Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, email, Google+. Simple ways that you can share Issues Etc. programs with your friends, relatives, and fellow parishioners. Just go to Listen on Demand Archives at issuesetc.org and look for the share feature images posted beneath each audio segment. You're only one click away from telling someone about Issues Etc. The Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org and look for Share This.
Would you like for us to post information about your congregation on the Find a Church page of our website? We'll add your church when it becomes part of the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to donate $1,000 to Issues Etc. Please consider adding the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. to your church's mission or advertising budget. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 at issuesetc.org. Click support and publicize your congregation to the world.
Expert guests, expansive topics, extolling Christ. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th Century. The 8th Century. The 4th Century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.